After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
Well, welcome back to the Greenhouse, dear listeners. Joining me today for a very special interview, I've actually been looking forward to this, is Professor Hajar Yazdiha. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's so good to be here.
So this interview is coming on the heels of MLK Day with a very timely, precise, and biting indictment of the time with Hajar's book, The Struggle for the People's King, a book that seems to have captured the entire spirit of everything we try to talk about here on Greenhouse Gaslighting when it comes to the strategic use of political rhetoric and social iconography, as well as the manipulation and distortion of collective memory when it comes to our shared history. So let's probably get into your book first. So your book, The Struggle for the People's King, is a powerful examination of how the legacy of Dr. King and the civil rights era as a whole sits within the entirety of American political discourse and ideology, when used in good and bad faith by a variety of causes and social interest groups, as well as how these memories are evoked by progressive and conservative forces alike. Can you speak to us about your motivations and experiences with regards to writing this book, as well as your interests in this particular era of history?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, so it's something I talk about in the preface of the book, and I think it's important because, you know, I want to situate myself within this question of, you know, I'm an Iranian American, so what am I doing writing a book about the co-optation of Black history? And, you know, what I talk about in the introduction is that I, you know, growing up in these predominantly white communities as somebody who actually wasn't even born here and who's the daughter of Iranian political refugees, you know, I always had that sense of this doesn't quite sit right. You know, we're acting like this is the multicultural era, and I'll, you know, age myself. I was growing up in like the late 80s and the 90s, and this was a time where we weren't really talking about racism anymore. We were acting like this was the colorblind era. And so now we're all kumbaya. It's the Benetton ads, right? It's just the whole rainbow of faces. And yet I'm still experiencing not just microaggressions, but when I'm out with my parents who have accents, we're expressing like macroaggressions, right? And so for me, it was trying to square away that disdain and then also the lack of a language around what it was for me as neither Black nor white to live in this country that's founded by racism. So, you know, what I talk about is it was the histories of Black thought that finally helped me make sense of my own experience. It was the folks like Du Bois and Baldwin and Audre Lorde. I mean, it's in reading them where I'm like, oh, I am not outside of the system of white supremacy. It is actually shaping both how other people see me and how I see myself. And so that for me was such a kind of foundational aha moment that is what then eventually led me to go and get my PhD in sociology. And I was always really interested in these questions of race and social change, and then also just, you know, what brings us together and what keeps us apart. And I mean, you know, the civil rights movement is like foundational to that story of inclusion and exclusion in this country. So it made sense to me that, you know, this is a question I was going to ask is both, you know, how it's foundational to the American story of who we are, but then also why it's so distorted and central to politics today, this historical revisionism. So that's kind of the pathway that got me here.
Yeah, and I recall you had spoken about some of those experiences on your appearance on the Future Hindsight podcast, as well as, you know, the preface of your book. So I could sympathize with some of those experiences myself, you know, being Indian American. And when you go through the history, right, some of the advantages or benefits that particularly brown Americans, and I say like us from immigrant backgrounds, that we get, you know, they came on the heels of real civil rights wins. So
yes,
it's, yeah, learning that history and seeing how it can tie back to you, even if you may not be directly connected, is very powerful work to do. And I think like it's one of those big reasons why standing up for solidarity, especially with people who may not look like you or live like you, that history is very important to understand and feel.
Yeah, I'm so glad that resonated with you too, because, you know, for me, it was always like a challenge growing up. And we didn't have a ton of Iranian American friends. I mean, we were part of the diaspora, obviously, but we weren't really connected to those spaces in large part because parents were, you know, really radicals. And so they just refused to buy in to the quote unquote American dream story. They refused to buy into the idea that we had somehow escaped something so repressive. They didn't believe that. You know, they loved their country. They didn't want to leave their country. And for them, it was this kind of realization that, you know, the United States is also deeply responsible for the fact that they had to leave, right? You know, like the way that American imperialism works. It's like the U.S. loves to tell this story about receiving immigrants without acknowledging that it's the reason a lot of them had to leave their homeland. So if, I think that was always part of my parents' critique and part of the reason they didn't connect with a lot of the Iranian American immigrants who really settled in and bought in and loved this story of having kind of made it in the United States. And then also who bought into the story of having left this quote unquote repressive place. So I think that also made it kind of hard for me to find places where I could have these conversations and see myself. And that's why learning these histories of racism was so eye-opening and really made me realize how much our country is just founded in every strand of culture on anti-blackness.
And I guess while we're in that similar vein, right, you know, your book, while it doesn't focus on MLK himself directly or the civil rights era, you know, as it exists as a sequence of historical events, it does examine the legacy and received image of MLK in American public consciousness. So maybe starting with that, you know, what's your overall take on MLK, especially when it comes to his real and imagined stature in our historical memory?
Yeah. Oh, I love that question. And it's so interesting, too, because I think I've been on a journey with my understanding of MLK and the way that I saw him. You know, growing up, you watch the I Have a Dream speech in school and they roll out the television, you know. And I remember that being such a powerful moment for me. I had chills. And I still get chills when I watch that speech just because he has such charisma. He speaks so much from the depth of his soul. But, you know, growing up and then especially starting to read the folks like Baldwin and Audre Lorde and having a much more critical consciousness, I actually thought, you know, MLK was kind of like a sellout, right? I was like, he's really trying to get white people to love black people. And that's just never going to happen. And I really didn't understand quite how radical he was until I started doing this work, because I came to this work thinking about, you know, why is he being co-opted in these egregious ways? But of course, part of it, even though I say in the introduction, I am not a historian, this is not a history of MLK or the civil rights movement, I had to learn a lot about him just to square it with the co-optations of him. And that's when I realized, I mean, first of all, he was deeply critical of white supremacy. He wasn't, you know, kind of this cheery, rosy-eyed optimist about the redemption of the American people and of America. And especially as his life progressed, he became more and more critical. And that resonated with me. I felt like that was the journey I had been on, from going to a place of thinking as a kid, well, maybe, you know, we can find ways to come together and maybe racism isn't as bad as it used to be, to being so deeply critical. And then the place I stand now in the wake of just the past few months, which is a deep pessimism about the redemptive capabilities of America.
Yeah, and it's hard to square that pessimism vis-a-vis, you know, like any idealism or any, like, you know, real instances of hope we can feel about how things are going, right? Yeah. With the just the existing trend of co-optation and cynicism writ large when it comes to making some of these changes. So I sympathize with that entirely.
Oh, well, you know what? Let me go back though to your initial question, because I think part of the answer is thinking about MLK's image today and kind of the difference between how he's imagined and how he was real. For me, a big part of it is, you know, one, how his humanity and his complexity has been written out in really strategic ways. And so it's not just that his radical history has been written out. It's also that his complexity as a person has been written out. The fact that he did get angry, right? That he had a temper, that he himself suffered from depression. A lot of the things that I think we individuals often characterize as personal flaws that make us feel like, well, we could never be an activist like the civil rights activist, or that we could never be of the stature of MLK. Mm-hmm. It's too easy to mythologize him and make him seem like this untouchable hero, when in fact, once you realize exactly who he was and the personal demons he had and how he struggled with them, you're like, actually, maybe the MLKs are among us, you know? And I think that that is such an important recognition, just for allowing the sense of agency to take on these systems that feel so immense and so powerful.
Yeah, like I even recall that back when Twitter was still usable, like I want to say a couple years ago, someone had made this thread of pictures of Dr. King, not, you know, on the march or giving speeches, but hanging out with his family and like playing pool, you know, yes, with like his back over the table and stuff. And people were like surprised with like, yeah, he's this hero, but he was also just, you know, a guy.
Yes.
And I know like I'm a bit younger than you, but I can at least recall in elementary school watching that one movie on MLK Day, or at least around the time. My friend Martin, it was that animated film. Did they ever show you that?
No, I think maybe that came after.
Oh my God.
Yeah, tell me about it.
So yeah, we're going to sidetrack this a bit, but this actually this is germane to the discussion overall. And we've talked about this on a past episode, but it's this animated film about this kid who gets like sent back in time and meets Dr. King as a kid. And there's this plot line where like the civil rights movement never happens. Dr. King doesn't become the person he's supposed to be. And there's this really weird scene. And this film came out, I think, after the events of the King holiday being passed have already occurred. There's this very strange scene of like the entirety of the civil rights movement happening and these big wins, and this child who will become Dr. MLK, you know, who becomes Dr. King, sees the future, realizes the inevitability, and steps into this door into the future, and then all we hear is a gunshot, and the movie fades to black.
Oh my God.
There's like a, you know, the stereotypical like reel of like, you know, white and brown faces and black faces smiling and, you know, people shaking hands, and that's how the movie ends. And when I was talking to my partner about that, we had kind of realized like that is the way you kind of as a society build this narrative of MLK, not as one of many or as somebody who was involved in a complex thing, but as a martyr for the American project. And like that specific moment of him walking into the door is that kind of apotheosis or creation of a martyr, that in your book, you touch on this heavily, that Reagan and others made him out to be. He became a martyr for the American symbol itself rather than a person bound by his very real and true context.
That's right. Oh, wow. And I just looked it up. I'm like, okay, that came out in 99. So I was in high school, which explains why I never got to see it. But I need to see it, because it sounds like if kids were watching this in elementary school, that is part of how this kind of mythology continued.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, I mean, it's wild. And I think the question of martyrhood is, or martyrdom, is really important, because it is part of the way that, for one thing, he gets sanitized and whitewashed. But I think for another, the way that he gets used in the service of upholding the nation's story of who it is as a kind of redemptive story, a story where racism ended with Martin Luther King. You know, Reagan even says in his speech, he's like, you know, he lifted the great burden of racism from this country. Mm-hmm. And it creates this perception that thanks to Dr. King, we're done with racism. We don't have to deal with it anymore. And so now if there's inequality, it's your own fault, right? You didn't pull yourself up from your bootstraps like Martin wanted you to. And, you know, we can turn to him as a figment of the past. That time is now gone. And we've moved on to a new chapter in American history, the colorblind era. And I think something I've been thinking about a lot lately is the way that the colorblind era itself is actually coming to an end, you know, and not that it mm-hmm. ever actually meant colorblindness, but colorblindness as a kind of political ideology that obscured racism. I mean, with Trump and the resurgence of this emboldened, explicit racism, it's making me wonder, you know, just how much are we kind of going in a weird cycle, or is this something brand new that's actually going to be quite more insidious than before?
That is the exact question that keeps me up at night as well.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, with that being said, as your book focuses on examining MLK's legacy and the ways in which it's strategically invoked, sometimes in good faith, sometimes in bad faith, why is it useful for us to examine his legacy and the ways in which it's used?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think one of the big arguments I make in the book is that it's easy to kind of write off these misuses of King as, you know, sort of disingenuous. Sometimes we're like, oh, they're just misinformed. But they're not just rhetorical devices. I mean, I'm really showing by tracing the 40 years of misuses, I'm showing that, for one thing, they're intentional strategies, because if you control the past, you control the future. But second, that they have really negative and disturbing consequences, including rolling back civil rights. So effectively using Dr. King's memory against the civil rights that he fought for. And it is part of the destruction of democracy, is this distorted history that allows us to legitimize these movements that are unrolling, you know, rolling back all of the gains that we made through the 60s, 70s, 80s. And I mean, for me, it's concerning on so many levels. I have two young kids, and even just on a basic level where I want them to understand why they're here, right? Their history, the way that it shapes our present. I mean, even that is being sacrificed through some of the ways King is being used to roll back historical education, limit our capacity to learn about Dr. King himself.
So with that also being said, what are the common misconceptions and distortions you've seen when it comes to recollections of, or when the civil rights movement gets evoked?
Oh my God, there's so many. So one of the big ones that I see all the time is that anytime there is some kind of mass movement, grassroots, it's coming out to challenge the government, it's coming out to challenge the status quo, you are always going to hear that Dr. King would be ashamed of you, that the civil rights movement would never do that. I mean, most recently, I saw this last week when there was this editorial about how these anti-war protesters that are shutting down bridges and highways, how they should be looking to the civil rights movement because that was a model of proper protest and civil protest. And I'm like, bruh, like they literally shut down highways.
They blocked bridges, yeah.
Yes. So I think that that's one of the big ones. I also think it's this idea that it was a lot of kind of, you know, good-hearted people coming together and that everybody was on the same page. The way that it kind of obscures and writes out all of the deep organizing, the time that it took, the thought that goes into organizing, I mean, that part makes it really hard then to recreate, especially for young people who look to it as some sort of magical model of people just landing in the streets and creating change immediately. I mean, it took years, right, of all of the sustained work. And so that piece gets written out. I think that's really dangerous. But I think it's also the piece where now we remember the civil rights movement as this thing that, you know, folks just came around to really quickly, and that the only people that were opposed were like the mean racists in the South. And that's a story that's really dangerous because so many people were opposed to the civil rights movement all across the country. They thought these folks were agitators. They thought they were disruptive. They thought they were anti-American. I mean, all of the conspiracies about King and the movement having communist ties, all of these things make it seem like, you know, now any movement that gets the terrorist category, which, for example, like Black Lives Matter, it was categorized as terrorist for a while, probably still is. You know, that makes it feel like, oh, if you looked at civil rights movement, everybody really felt good about that one. But no, you know, 75% of Americans like hated King in the last year of his life. And I think understanding that dissent is always deeply unpopular when it challenges the status quo, when it challenges the norm, I think that could help people just kind of rethink how they're approaching, you know, their own feelings. I always say, like, just get curious about it. If you have antipathy toward the movements that are trying to change society, take a minute, take a beat, and think about what that antipathy is rooted in, especially when you think about the fact that protest and dissent, unpopular work like this, has always been a cornerstone of democracy.
Exactly. And I guess we can jump into the discussion a bit deeper now. So as I was reading your text, it reminds me very much of a framework we've discussed on this podcast very often, of American civil religion as posited by Robert Bella, I think sometime in the 60s. So in that framework, we can understand institutional resistance to progress and a controlled reverence of historical figures, where Dr. King, you know, as we've talked about earlier, in some ways has become a martyr. And this process is something that you described very brilliantly in your book with Reagan's handling of making MLK Day a national holiday. So what do you make of this idea or framework when it comes to understanding American political institutions or the distortion of the historical memory and the legacy of Dr. King?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting framework to put on this. For one thing, I think we could think about how Dr. King gets molded into this idea of like the founding fathers and the nation's sort of core symbols and rituals that give it a sense of who it is and help everybody kind of buy in. But, you know, at the same time, I always think civil religion's kind of been a strategy much more than a sort of genuine set of shared beliefs. It's always been a strategy from the top to keep people in line, to manufacture consent. And it's always been for a particular group. And so even with the expansion of civil religion to include MLK with, as you mentioned, Reagan, who hated MLK and hated civil rights, that in itself was a strategy, because the idea was if we can fold him into the story of American exceptionalism and use him as a symbol of, you know, free market and the promise of individual liberties and state rights, then we don't have to threaten who we are by folding King in. And that's why, you know, Reagan and also a lot of these right-wing conservatives resisted the King holiday for so long, because they did hate King. They thought he was, you know, a communist sympathizer and that he really threatened the American story of itself. He was a threat to the American civil religion. So, you know, to whitewash him was to find a way to fit him into that story, but not necessarily to do anything revolutionary. So for me, it's much more of, I'm trying to remember it. So it's the scholar Lynn Itagaki, and she's kind of countered the idea of civil religion with the idea of civil racism, which is the idea that, you know, the U.S. has never actually been inclusive as a philosophy. And so that exclusion, that kind of pushing people out of who's within the sort of conception of the civil religion, conception of who's American, who's part of our populace, that's always been really fraught. And so she, you know, says that the kind of American idea would be more meaningful if more recognition were actually given to a lot of these people's histories from the ground. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of both and, because it's both that, yes, you know, MLK has been part of the expansion of civil religion in the face of multicultural democracy and having to contend with the shifting demographics of America with a, you know, post-1965 moment. And it has been a way to shut down genuine criticisms of that exclusion. And so it's like a veneer, right? I've described it as like King has become a moral cloak. And I think civil religion is the same way. It's kind of moral cloak. It's a sort of cheery story that's invoked by both the left and the right alike. Establishment folks who want to uphold the status quo and the idea that America is exceptional, that there is something different about being from the United States. I mean, for them, this is critical.
I think that's spot on. And you mentioned this in your book as well, that by design, when they do allow the momentum towards a King holiday to move forward, the vision and version of Dr. King that gets publicized is a very specific one, as you mentioned. It's not the one where towards the end of his life, he's speaking about the ills of militarism, imperialism, and, you know, supporting striking sanitation workers. It's the one where, you know, he eases America's burden of racism permanently and, you know, gets brought up to, you know, get people to pull themselves up by the bootstraps, as we proverbially say, right? So. Right. It's a dual sanitation or sanitization. Oh my God. of his legacy, as well as like a very vicious way to obscure the historical record and co-opt him for a fundamentally right-wing project.
Yes. I mean, I think the way that Reagan so strategically ties his own legacy to King's so that, you know, he can claim, I'm not racist. I signed the King Holiday into law, and I invoke King at every turn as I'm rolling back civil rights because I'm claiming that King would be opposed to, you know, having all of these sort of standards around discrimination. Because for Reagan, you should have the individual right to discriminate. And so he's using King's words to do that work. And I think that's actually been, you know, as I've been talking to different audiences, that for many people has been a surprise because it's easy to think, as I did when I came to the project initially, that this is just a newer phenomenon that comes out of reactionary politics after Obama's presidency. I mean, I initially was like, oh, this is where it should probably be rooted, is this is the reaction to the quote unquote post-racial era after we have a Black president. And, you know, no, once you realize it actually goes all the way back and that those initial gains of the civil rights movement had spurred just such deep reactionary politics, reactionary strategy. I mean, just thinking about, I mean, you all have talked about the moral majority on the show. And I think a lot of it is rooted in a politics that had a long view. The right-wing conservative evangelicals, with the help of folks in a lot of power with a lot of wealth, have done a really good job of playing the long game. And once you see just how long this has been building and snowballing, I mean, I even say in the book that when you actually look at that evidence, it predicted the Trump presidency. So for everybody who was talking about how this was a blind spot and they don't understand how Trump got elected, well, all of the evidence was there. You just had to be paying attention to it.
Exactly. So while this is the broad focus of your book, I mean, pretty much chapters 2 through 6 cover this topic, so we might be spoiling this a bit. But you know, what trends do you see in political discourse here in the United States, especially when it comes to the strategic use or the invocation of the memory of Dr. King and the civil rights struggle?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the book, when I trace these 40 years, I thematize them essentially into what I call these kind of gnarled branches of memory, because the common conception is that memory is sort of one solid thing and it progresses in a sort of long trajectory. And as I was looking at all these different invocations of memory, it was very clear that they fell into certain camps, and not just that they were these different camps or different branches, but also that they were deeply intertwined. And so they were really working in opposition to one another. And so when you think about the Reagan institutionalization of the King holiday and the King memory, I describe it as these two initial fractures, where on the one hand, you have the memory that the King Center, Coretta Scott King, and the folks that have been really fighting for the King holiday, which includes the Congressional Black Caucus. This memory of King is the one that understands his dream as an unfinished set of goals, right? And so it's the work that needs to continue to challenge those three pillars that he talked about. I actually would say now that there was far more complexity in that, and I will shout out an amazing book called Prophet of Discontent by Andrew Douglas and Jared Loggins, and this is a book that really takes on the question of King's, you know, kind of critique of racial capitalism and the way that he was a socialist. And so I recommend it because I think it actually gets to the heart of some of the concessions that the King family had to make King palatable, to make him acceptable for a national holiday. They had to write out some of these radical critiques. And so though they were preserving the unfinished dream, they did have to kind of take the neoliberal stance of, you know, well, we're still fighting for Black inclusion into the neoliberal project rather than challenging it altogether. But then on the other hand, this other branch, the one that's much more insidious and the one that we see so explicitly today, is the right-wing co-optation that comes with Reagan. And this is a way to preserve a quote-unquote colorblind neoliberal king who was the kind of model of American exceptionalism, the American dream. And this is the king that gets used in the service of rolling back civil rights. So it's really from these two branches that a lot of our contemporary political discourse has grown. And I mean, I talk about from these branches, you get like the anti-war movement that brings out King and his anti-war stance, his critique of Vietnam and American imperialism. I actually think this is one that we see a lot today. I mean, I wrote an op-ed about it. You also get, though, the King that's all about civility and moderation. And again, this is one of the distortions, but this is one that you see frequently in today's politics, is this idea that, you know, folks from the left have gotten out of hand. It's where you see folks invoking the idea of this dangerous woke culture. And I know you all talk about the culture wars a lot on this show. I've always felt like the culture wars are one-sided in the sense that it is a war being fought by the right wing for a very long time to create the perception that there is a war. Whereas on the left, it's never really been about just culture, really. It's been about fundamental, you know, restorative, changing resource distribution, right? And so in changing deep structures. So I think that's where it's gotten challenging, is because so much of the organizing on the left has had to contend with the right in this discussion of a culture war. And mm-hmm. so constantly wading into these battles over semantics and, you know, what do we mean by critical race theory? What do we mean by DEI? And all the while missing that they're being chipped away underneath while we are mm-hmm. distracted. So those, I mean, for me, those are some of the central ways that he's been distorted and kind of shaped political discourse, because it is this constant battle between, you know, like, who do we actually want to be as the United States, as quote unquote Americans? Like, who do we believe we are and who counts as a legitimate American? And right now, when you hear Trump, you know, putting out discourse about like poisoning the blood, you realize, you know, the danger is... You know, the call is coming from inside the house, effectively, right? This is nothing. This is nothing new.
Spot on. And I think in traditional greenhouse gaslighting fashion, we've really skipped ahead in the outline, which is great. Because I think I broke that down into probably three questions and you answered all of them. So.
Oh, I'm good at going on my rambles.
Perfect. No, that's why we wanted you on. So. I guess maybe we can ask this one real quick. Are there any concrete differences between how progressives and conservatives invoke these memories?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I talk a lot about in the book how well-intentioned progressive groups, including immigrant rights activists, LGBTQ groups, will often invoke a king that is quote-unquote colorblind in the sense that they're preserving this idea that he represented the promise of a beloved community where it's all about inclusion and kind of fuzzy feelings. And both of those groups over time have to contend with the fact that by doing that, they're actually preserving a kind of anti-Black story where they're mm-hmm. not recognizing systemic racism. They're not recognizing the systemic inequality. And so this is a story we start our conversation with, which is one where you're building your movement on the backs of Black people instead of meaningfully being in community with them and in solidarity with them. But in both of those cases, you know, those sort of false invocations early on, they develop and they start to create these internal reckonings where then they do start to pick up more radical critiques and sort of contend with the internal anti-Blackness. And those are, I think, some of the continuing challenges of progressive movements in general, is kind of thinking about their internal power dynamics. I mean, I talk in the book about some of the challenges between the white feminists and the Black feminists as Me Too comes about. And mm-hmm. you know, white feminists really have to grapple with the anti-Black roots of their movement. But, you know, on the right, that has been much more of the clear, intentional political distortion and historical revisionism. And people often ask me, like, well, how do you know it's intentional? And I tell them, because it's in writing, right? There are mm-hmm. all of these documents from behind the scenes, these strategy papers where they're talking about using civil rights as a wedge issue, effectively saying to Black Americans, for example, you know, gay people who are much more wealthy than you are trying to say that gay rights are civil rights. And so they try to create these wedge issues quite successfully at times. Mm-hmm. And, or for example, they'll go to Black people and say, well, immigrants are taking your jobs and they're trying to say that immigrant rights are civil rights. And, you know, it's not like Black people are, you know, these kind of political pawns that get to play about. I mean, they don't buy it most of the time, but at times they will use Black conservatives as the face of their movement. So right-wing groups will have Black people come out and display their messages to gain legitimacy for the idea that, you know, they are the carrying the mantle of civil rights, right? Mm-hmm, I think that's actually one of the things I think about a lot, is the sort of strategic use of Black identity while actually preserving and reproducing these anti-Black causes. And you could look to like the Ben Carsons, for example, as an example of this.
Right.
Or the Candace Owens, you know. So, I mean, I think those are the two main differences, but there's also a lot of complexity within. And I think the left, for me, is always going to be of more interest because that's where I situate myself. Right. And I see so many challenges with a kind of democratic establishment, the corporate Democrats, And then those of us who are much more committed to deeper structural changes. And unfortunately, I've been thinking more recently about, you know, King complains about the white moderate as the real stumbling block to progress. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And for me now, it's like the white Democrat, because of the way everything's moved so far to the right. It's like the white liberal establishment is really the problem.
Yeah, in some ways, like, I guess we can argue that Joe Biden is the embodiment of that writ large.
Yep.
And like a lot of what you said there, like I can resonate on that, just, you know, on personal experience. Like in 2016, when Trump first got elected, I can recall that leading up to Election Day, there were a lot of like targeted radio ads that would invoke these civil rights like styles of speaking in them to try to drive a wedge between Black people and immigrant communities in Metro Detroit, which is, you know, incredibly diverse and also has a very high Black population. And they were trying to drive a wedge of, hey, vote for Trump. These people are stealing your jobs. So that wedge strategy that you've discussed in your book that's existed for quite some time is nothing new. In fact, it's being deployed maybe more aggressively and more often, which is why people are starting to get hip to it. And also, like you were mentioning earlier with immigrants' rights struggles, you know, even if well-meaning, may sometimes reassert anti-Black narratives or anti-Black structures. This was something that Vijay Prashad brings up in his book, Uncle Swami, which is a book explaining, like, you know, the dynamics of Indian Americans as a political demographic in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of had this this take in the book where Indian Americans were able to benefit from two progressive struggles they weren't directly participating in. The first being, you know, the struggle for independence. You know, folks back home are fighting the British and win that struggle. So you win the prestige of being, you know, part of this background that's defeated this colonial power and the prestige that that gives you and your people. But then also Black Americans in their struggle for civil rights had a cascading domino of effects for everyone else.
Yes.
That, you know, is for Asian Americans writ large. We were, in fact, bigger recipients of certain civil rights wins than Black people when it came to immediately reaping the benefits.
Right.
So, you know, it's one of those things that even if you're not white but not Black, you know, it's a kind of thing where we see certain right-wing or anti-Black subcultures in immigrant you know, communities or subcultures within, like, at least in my background, you know, like with Desi people, there are certain anti-Black, you know, narratives and rhetoric. And that's one of those reasons why I think it's important we all stand up for solidarity with each other, because at least in the history of the United States, you know, we owe some of our rights and some leniences we get as model minorities to the struggles Black people have had to face. Exactly.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I wrote an LA Times op-ed about a very similar argument, and I wish that more folks could listen to what you're saying and buy it, because it is a hard argument to make amongst folks that are so proud of the gains they've made in this country, who truly believe that they are model minorities and model citizens and they should be rewarded as such, but don't understand just how much their ability to be a quote-unquote model, and then also the strategy of making them a model, is built on the backs of Black people. And I think, you know, the solidarity politics piece is something, again, that keeps me up at night, because it's so challenging to commit to a true solidarity politics that's not just performative, mm-hmm. that's not just a one-off in the face of, you know, these exogenous threats, whether it's like the Muslim ban, for example, or surveillance.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one of the things I talk about in the chapter on the Muslim rights movement, is those challenges within Muslim immigrant communities. And this question of folks that, like, really, really want to just, you know, blend into the dominant group, but that particularly in the post-9/11 moment are realizing that no matter how well integrated they are, whether they've lived in these communities with white people for decades, you know, become doctors, be wealthy, you know, have all the things, they will still be seen as other. And it's the bumping up against boundaries of American identity that I talk about a lot, because I think it's those realizations that can actually create a political consciousness to do much more of the critical work and get into the solidarity politics. Because you have to understand that you have linked fate with these other groups. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's hard to kind of buy into the idea that this is going to serve you in any way.
100%. So I know you did touch on this in an earlier response about, you know, the culture war. I guess I never saw it in the sense that it's one-sided, but I completely agree with your assessment there. And, you know, we see the exacerbation of the culture war here in the United States, you know, as neoliberalism remains our dominant system when it comes to determining overall governance. And it often, you know, drives our directives for domestic and foreign policy. So how do you foresee various political actors, you know, deploying their invocation of civil rights and maybe MLK in the coming year? And maybe it's too early to predict, who knows?
I know. I mean, it's a hard question. But I mean, even right now with the responses we're seeing to the war, and I don't want to call it a war because I don't believe it is. Again, I think if, you know, one side has all the power and the resources, it's not exactly a war. But with the assault on Palestinians,
right,
I think we're already seeing even just this schism within the quote-unquote left. And these schisms have always existed and been, you know, kind of dangerous for our ability to work together. But I'm at the point where I see it as irreparable. And it's interesting, too, because the invocation of memory has not just been the invocation of civil rights memory in this sense. It's also been the invocation of memories of genocide. And
right.
The question, right? And the question of, first of all, who owns that memory, but then also what the memory itself actually means for the present. And something that I do talk about in the book is the fact that when you freeze memories in time and you don't allow them to move with context, it becomes actually dangerous, right? And it's not the idea that you should be co-opting and revising for each moment, but it is the idea that if you don't understand the context in which the memory was embedded and the power dynamics that shaped it, if you think that it's just a memory that you're going to use as a tool, then you are going to use it in all sorts of ways that it weaponize it against the very horrors that shaped the actual moment. So, you know, when we think about never again, it's that question of, you know, is it never again for everyone or is it never again for one group? And so I think that question of memory comes up too, and thinking about all of the domestic assaults on DEI, on queer folk, all of the rolling back across the board. And I was actually disturbed to see recently, I don't even want to give it the airtime, but I was disturbed to see that Charlie Kirk is planning to take on Dr. King's memory by now saying Dr. King was a bad guy. And we should be repealing the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act was a bad piece of legislation, which is interesting because that's the exact thing that Reagan said. So, So it's actually, for me, it's accelerated in a way I didn't anticipate. I thought we'd be like maybe 10, 20 years from now trying to trouble Dr. King's memory because of the reaction to the left picking up his radical legacy. But it looks like, you know, we're going to be getting rid of King more quickly than I anticipated.
Yeah, Charlie Kirk is one desperate hack for that.
I don't
want to lose it on air, but yeah, that's...
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, that's the sad thing, though, right? These hacks, I mean, even like the Chris Rufos, these political strategies are really effective. And the fact that folks can, like Chris Rufo, can be on Twitter, they can literally be tweeting out the strategy 2 weeks in advance about, you know, for example, the DEI thing, right, with Claudine Gay.
Right, right.
How we're going to drop it on the right, create the outrage, and then we're going to drop it into the kind of mainstream left. And as usual, the New York Times plays in, they pick it up, and it becomes mm-hmm. a thing. And so the way that media, for example, I mean, for me, media in the book is hugely complicit in this revisionist history because they pick up all of these false invocations and represent them uncritically. They give them front pages. They don't contextualize them and talk about how they're actually false invocations of history. And they call it representing both sides. And so they can write it off as kind of journalistic guidelines, as opposed to thinking about how by putting it on the front page and not representing the real and truthful history, They are giving it all of the air it needs to grow and become mainstream.
And this is why, like, it's particularly important and it's very prescient, all that your book gets into for understanding this recent just fiasco. I don't know what else to call it, right? You know, this project by Chris Rufo and that insipid gang with the, you know, with getting Claudine Gay all ousted, you know, regardless of what people may think about Claudine Gay or the Academy or, you know, elite institutions, what can definitely be said is that this cohort has won in two ways. One, which is their, you know, incessant railing on anything that acknowledges, you know, disparities in American communities with their assault on DEI. Mm-hmm. And also they've really muddied the waters when it comes to any fair-handedness or measured consideration when it comes to how we address Palestinian liberation. And, you know, as we talk about the invocation of historical memory, right? As all this has been popping off, we are seeing, and this has been kind of swept under the rug as a result of how this cohort has been acting, of people who are Jewish, you know, asking good questions about the narratives and propaganda used by the state of Israel to justify its existence, to justify violence and just all manner of horrible things, right? And how earlier last year, you know, in New York City, Jewish Voice for Peace put on a protest. And the big, one of the signs that really got to me was, you know, when people were holding up signs with "not in my name," you know, that was a necessary and also strategically important move to decry the violence and also to remind people that, hey, historical memory is being invoked to certain ends. And we were also hearing, like, you know, Jewish Americans comment on the ways in which, you know, the real trauma, both immediate and felt, you know, historically across generations, right, of the Holocaust, is invoked to justify all manner of things. And you know, as non-Jewish, you know, like, Christian Zionists also leverage that to their own insidious ends. This framework you've laid out in your book for understanding how history can be co-opted and used viciously by the right to justify and promulgate all manners of right-wing, you know, propaganda and activities is very important for us to understand as we go through this year.
Yes. Yeah. No, you put it so beautifully. And yeah, definite shout out to just the super inspiring and brave organizations, you know, Jewish Voice for Peace, If Not Now, Standing Together. So many incredible Jewish leaders just at the forefront of standing in solidarity with Palestinian people. And yeah, saying "not in my name," and to invoke their own personal family histories of being Holocaust survivors or having even, you know, been killed in the Holocaust, I think is such a powerful way to make that connection between past and present. And of course, historical analogies are never perfect. And I think this is where a lot of people kind of, you know, fall off as they say, well, you know, these are the ways that it's different, and therefore the analogy doesn't stand. And this is the part where I always think about the sociology of it, is you have to be able to look at it from an eagle's eye view and look at the arrangement of power, look at who is the oppressed group within the situation, you know, who is coming from the grassroots, who is in the position where, you know, nobody has stood with them. Their group has been invisibilized and silenced, right? And think about what state power lies behind each group. I mean, I think in that sense, it's a lot easier to make these analogies and not to use them as these kind of perfect outlines of, you know, what should happen and what we should do, but rather to help it be a bridge. And I describe collective memory as a bridge in these opportunities, where it's a way that you can bring people together in solidarity, in a collective fight for collective liberation, as opposed to using it as a wedge, as something to harden boundaries between groups and to establish what feels like a central difference between groups.
100%. I completely, yeah, well said. So as we observe what seems to be an overall breakdown in consensus reality, in what context do you determine the legitimate invocation of collective memory or history? Can legitimacy ever even be a thing to be ascribed to such things?
Oof, that's such a hard one. Yeah, I mean, I've struggled too with the idea that there was ever consensus reality. I mean, I think there was consensus reality in the sense that there was strong dominant narrative, and because of the fact that we didn't have all of this fragmented media environment, we didn't have so much isolation in our individual lives, because of the kind of breakdown of our safety net, our economic structures, the way that it's created so much individualism and sort of this fragmentation, like I said, mm-hmm. in the ways we get information. I mean, I think, yes, the consensus reality is worse now than ever. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is that the way collective memory gets co-opted and kind of creates these divergent social realities makes it impossible to talk to each other, because I say, you know, it's not even like we're just in different political camps and we're polarized. It's like we're on different planets, right? We're truly not seeing one another. We're not seeing reality the same way. It's like we're living in different worlds. And I think a lot about what that means for the future, and don't see this sort of magical silver bullet of we just teach everybody the true history and they come around and their eyes are opened. I say in the conclusion that I don't think formal education is like the pathway out of this.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do say that I do think it's incredibly important that we correct the record, right? I do think it's important we actively advocate against the legislation that tries to limit our historical education or completely obscure it. At the same time, I mean, I think true history, true collective memory is always going to be rooted in the people who experienced it firsthand. I mean, those are the bearers, and they're the people that they hand it down to. So I always say, like, you know, Black communities are always going to be the bearers of true civil rights history. And at the same time, you know, as time passes and the original civil rights activists are passing away. And for example, John Lewis was one of the big greats. And once he passed away, there was this idea, well, who's going to carry on civil rights legacy and kind of the true story now?
Mm-hmm.
But it lives on in the art. It lives on in the documents, the words, you know, it lives on in the stories. And so even though there may never be one single factual sort of truth, because of course the truth is always experienced differently, I am always going to yield to the stories from below, the people's histories, because I believe they are the ones that have experienced it with full eyes. They have seen it for what it is. And one of the kind of great revelations I've had, even in my own research, and it's something I felt personally, but maybe just thought was just me, is that it's the folks that are on the margins who have experienced the social world and all of this power from outside who actually see the forest for the trees. And it is, you know, it's like the double consciousness that Du Bois talked about, right? It's that you actually, through that veil, you have a double sight, and it can be a gift because it does allow you to see far more than those in power who are blinded. They cannot see the world beyond the one they've been given because it has served them. But for those who can imagine something else, a future that looks different from the one that we've always had, that's always been given, I mean, that's where the liberation lies. And so, I mean, it's like a very long-winded way to say it. I couldn't tell you like what one sort of legitimate invocation is, but I do think that the stories of the people are the signal. They will guide us.
So maybe in that vein directly, I might just jumble the outline here. So what do you make of historical retellings in the vein of Howard Zinn's A People's History of the U.S., or really any framing of a people's history, you know, that emphasize big picture analysis that do center the plights of the underrepresented over, you know, the traditional great men of history narratives?
Oh, I mean, oh my God, obviously, I think they're incredible. I even give like the Zen Ed Project a shout out in my conclusion.
Mm-hmm,
I think those are the stories that we should be telling. And it's not to say that we should get rid of like the dominant narrative. I actually think it's a valuable exercise to preserve both. It's really about hearing more sides, right? It's about triangulating and thinking about, okay, well, if this is the dominant narrative of what happened, what is the political project behind that? to tell this particular version of the story. So what gets lost when we leave out the accounts by whoever was targeted by XYZ policy, whoever is left out of the story? And I think it's in thinking about the silences, right? And, you know, there's the historian trio, Michel Rolf trio, not a good French pronunciator, but he writes about how history is just a set of actively enforced silences. And for me, it's the actively enforced silences that we should be interrogating. So, you know, I always think like any kind of people's history is excellent. And but that is also part of the reason it's so important for us now in present day to make sure that we're preserving the record, even with sharing, for example, the news from the ground in Gaza. Like people are always saying, mainstream news is not covering this, and the political establishment has it in their best interest to preserve like a certain narrative, to distribute the propaganda, to silence certain things that are going on. So look to the people, right? Where mm-hmm. are those silences? Listen to what they're saying. I think that can be really helpful.
That's spot on. Do you think the problematic aspects or consequences of the invocation of collective memory in history are worsened by poor or limited political education and consciousness?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting because I did say, like, I don't think formal education is the key, but for sure it doesn't help that our educational system kind of sucks. Like, it sucks in so many ways. It sucks because, you know, it's, like, poorly funded, mm-hmm. and then strategically so. And then also that it tells, you know, limited histories that, you know, Americans just in general don't have a strong sense of history. We are not a country that, you know, reflects on the past as much as we need to. And again, that is part of the project of making sure that we don't actually understand the roots of the social inequality around us or understand the world around us. I talk about Charles W. Mill's, you know, epistemology of ignorance argument, which I think is so strongly at play here. The idea that creating this culture of white ignorance in particular is a strategy to make sure that we don't understand why the world is the way that it is. Because if we did, then we would start thinking about like the tools to change it. So when I think about political education, I think one of the great tragedies too is the way that we think about civic engagement purely as voting. Mm-hmm. And I teach a class on grassroots participation. And one of the things we talk about in the class a lot is that grassroots participation doesn't mean that your only role as a quote-unquote citizen is to vote. Voting, as I say in the conclusion, is the bare minimum. And in fact, sometimes voting yields what you see now. So, you know, I think there's so much more that we ought to be teaching our children about how to be involved and to feel like they have agency within this unbelievably, you know, disturbing and overwhelming world where it's really easy to feel like nothing you do actually matters. And even for folks who are actively involved in social movements, they know that the burnout comes easy because you are not likely to yield the mass systemic changes that you want to within a week, within a month, you know, not even necessarily within your lifetime. But mm-hmm. I think learning that those practices, the practices of resistance, of having the consciousness, even the political education to understand that resistance is critical to a functioning democracy, I think all of those things are just kind of the sad consequences of a world where a very sort of strong 0.1% has controlled every infrastructure in society mm-hmm. and then also convinced us that we need it.
Mm-hmm. Further on that, you know, what role does or has the internet played in all this? How does the decreasing quality and deregulation of social media serve to exacerbate this?
I mean, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts because, like, from a, you know, scholarly perspective, obviously there's evidence of both outcomes. So one outcome is, yes, that decreasing information, like decreasing media literacy, all of these things allow a lot of disinformation to thrive, allow us to live within these kind of echo networks, you know, allow us to take in extreme outrage industry information that only preserves our own worldview and makes us believe that other people are against us. But then on the other hand, there is the evidence that it actually helps us be more interconnected in a global sense, that we get access to ideas we wouldn't have otherwise, that we find spaces of connection that we otherwise couldn't, especially for those of us that might have sort of identities that just don't fall within dominant spaces or even within the spaces where we live. So for me, it's like I take a two-part response to that. I think on the one hand, and this is central to my grassroots participation class, I truly believe being involved face-to-face with real people in your community is just one of the best ways to have a sense of purpose, to remind yourself that you are a social being and that you are meant to be in community with other people. But that the internet isn't really the devil here. Like, the devil is the folks that control the internet. So I think it's an important distinction to make because, you know, of course, the internet is not something that's void of human input, but it's really the way that these folks like Musk, for example, are controlling the algorithms of, you know, the Mark Zuckerbergs. Like, these are the folks that we really should be looking at. Like, you know, the internet should be a public good. And Twitter, for a while, was an incredible space for civil society. So I think we have to think about it like a little more critically, because I do hear a lot of, especially like older folks being like, the internet is the source of all of this now. Like, nobody's looking at each other, just looking at their phones. And I'm like, no, there's a little bit more going on there.
Yeah, I mean, definitely there's days where I feel super crotchety and I just think the computer is the devil. I definitely have my low moments like that. But yeah. I think you're spot on there, where it's like there's an apparatus at play here that dictates who controls the internet. Just because we all get on it and use it doesn't mean we really own it. And I think this is, it's a question we've perseverated on a lot on this show. I don't know if I'm anywhere conclusive with like a final take, but something that's really been in the back of my mind all of last year and even now is this fact that when we hop online, and whether it's social media, whether it's YouTube, podcasts, all manner of entertainment, and even like in the civic engagement, left-wing media space, right? There is a kind of commodification of your content that even if, you know, you have the best intentions, best ethics, best principles on how you get it out into the world, you don't even take a single cent of your subscribers' money, let alone any corporate backers. Whether you know, have the best takes and you're somehow able to convert all of it to action, you know, you're still selling a product. You're still working in a space that has market logic. And as long as the internet is this literal marketplace of ideas, we will continue to see people approach political discourse and social realities with this kind of taint of market logic that I'm not sure how we intend to square the circle with. And I think with this, you know, recurrence of the online right, you know, I kind of credit some of it to their ability to offer people social credit and social clout. You know, I think people really do gain a sense of social influence and social capital from highly online spaces and online, you know, content production. And the influence of that on how not just political discourse occurs, but even political engagement and ideology, you know, I'm not sure if that's been particularly studied or well examined. As of now, you know, all I can really think of is people talking about it, you know, anecdotally, or maybe there's like an editorial someone writes or an op-ed, but I don't know if it's been formally researched either.
Yeah, I buy that, though. Yeah, no, you're making a really good argument. I mean, it's like at the end of the day, it goes back to something my dad has been saying since we were kids. And my sister and I used to laugh that, like, if the weather was even bad, he would blame this. But, you know, he always said the root of every problem in this world is capitalism. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, well, it's like, yeah, let's take it at its source.
Exactly. And I think your overall take that how do you not only just democratize the internet so that it's easy to get on and produce content, but that people have ownership over the internet and they have you know, more control over how it comes to them, so that they're not being sold products, that they're not being subject to algorithms that favor certain social and political narratives, that, you know, if it's having a harmful impact on people's mental and physical health, that they have the means to maybe regulate or limit that. I think that's the direction society should go towards, but, you know, that's not even a formalized movement, let alone, you know, people calling for it as a political project. So that's another thing entirely.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I think it's a good sort of ethos, and it does, you know, resonate with, like I say in the conclusion, I say, you know, what we really need is to goal in our spiritual consciousness. And I say this as somebody who was raised an atheist and is still very much agnostic. But by spiritual, I really just mean like being in commune with humans and also with the earth, right? And so that does require like leaving your house and going and being in nature. But I think it's more than a like sort of woo-woo idea. I actually think that it sharpens your capacity to see everything for what it is, and then also to feel the kind of inner strength to take action.
You heard it here, folks. Professor Yazdi has said touch grass.
I'm a tree hugger. Tree hugger at heart.
What role does the academy or do educators have in correcting the proliferation of incorrect or problematic invocations of history?
Oh, I struggle with this because I think there's like this elitism amongst, especially the academy. I mean, I think educators are doing the most noble work. So, you know, my sister's a high school English teacher, so shout out to her. But I think there's this elitism that presumes that we somehow have the knowledge that folks should be listening to, and, you know, that we are the ones that have to do the work of correcting all this. I actually think it goes back to that question of people's histories. And if we as a culture can lift up those people's histories more readily, if we can counter the revisionist histories at every turn and not take them as just sort of a rhetorical move or a political one-off, we can take them seriously as the political strategies that they are and the insidious strategies that they are. I think that's one of the first ways that we can really kind of reclaim the legacy of the civil rights movement, of Dr. King, of these true histories. And I think the other piece is a larger piece where we have to make it really clear that understanding our history is not just for the exercise of learning and expanding our mind. It's really a way to understand both who we are in the present and then, you know, what we're doing, right? And why it's happening. So it's really that question of the critical consciousness, that we cannot understand our present and where we're going if we don't understand where we've been.
Yep. So that brings us to our final, and actually this might be the hardest question of the interview. So do you have any prescriptions or directives when it comes to reclaiming the legacy and will of Dr. King and the civil rights movement?
Oh, yeah, you asked the hard ones. Well, you know, the thing that I say is, so this is like the cute acronym, but I actually think it sums up a lot of the things that I'm thinking. So it's ARC for ARC, which is referring to the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And the A is for advocate. And for me, advocate doesn't necessarily mean just for legal changes and policy changes, although I do think that's important because, like I said, we really do have to actively take on a lot of these moves to restrict education and roll back civil rights and really dismantle multicultural democracy. We can debate whether it ever really existed. But advocate also just means to advocate for truth. And then the R is for relate, which, again, isn't just relating to one another, although I think that's important. It's also about relating to the past, whether it's our individual history and kind of the roots of our families and how they kind of came to be where they are, or the roots of our communities, you know, and then also, of course, national histories and global histories as well. But C is the one that I'm really passionate about because I think it's the one we don't talk about enough, which is C for create. And I think it's creation that really pushes us to expand our imagination. And I think our political imaginations have been so limited by trying to reproduce and kind of make these incremental changes and reforms within a system that has never served us. And so create does mean to take on a lot of the work of, you know, the Afrofuturists, for example, mm-hmm. trying to imagine worlds that have never been, but then to try to create them, right? Whether it's like in our small communities, creating our little communes, you know, but also then trying to scale up and do the solidarity politics of creating change on a global level.
I think that's spot on. Well, that's probably everything. We've really thoroughly exhausted my outline. I know you mentioned prior to recording that you were worried about these, but I think this has been a really great interview. And I just wanted to make sure to plug your book, The Struggle for the People's King, How Politics Transforms the Memory of the Civil Rights Movement. Available hardcover, paperback, and ebook at Princeton University Press. I'll have the links to that in the show notes as well.
Awesome. I'm so grateful that you had me and just that you have this space. Like, y'all are having really good conversations here. So I'm grateful for that.
I appreciate that. And again, it's amazing to encounter someone's work that encapsulates a lot of the questions and things you've been, you know, ruminating about, and read their book and tie a lot of those thoughts together. And then to have, you know, the chance to interview them on your show, like I feel very privileged to have, you know, have gotten something like this to happen. So thank you again for coming on the show.
No, likewise. Thank you so much.
Is there anything else in addition to the book that you would like to plug?
Well, the Zen Ad Project, obviously amazing. I think follow them on Instagram and, you know, amplify their work. And then also, I would love to lift up the Poor People's Campaign, which is Reverend William Barber is, you know, doing the resurgent Poor People's Campaign. It's not getting enough attention.
All right. I'll have links to that in the show notes as well as more Professor Yazdiha's work, as well as her website and our own social media links as well. So with all that being said, thanks for tuning in, dear listeners. Happy Dr. King Day to everybody. And we'll see you for the next episode. Take care.
The second aspect of our afflicted society is extreme materialism. An Asian writer has portrayed our dilemma in candid terms. He says, "You call your 1,000 material devices labor-saving machinery, yet you are forever busy with the multiplying of your machinery. You grow increasingly fatigued, anxious, nervous, dissatisfied. Whatever you have, you want more. And wherever you are, you want to go somewhere else. Your devices are neither time-saving nor soul-saving machinery. There are so many sharp spurs which urge you on to invent more machinery and to do more business. This tells us something about our civilization that cannot be cast aside as a prejudiced charge by an Eastern thinker who is jealous of Western prosperity. We cannot escape the indictment. This does not mean that we must turn back the clock of scientific progress. No one can overlook the wonders that science has wrought for our lives. The automobile will not abdicate in favor of the horse and buggy, or the train in favor of the stagecoach, or the tractor in favor of the hand plow, or the scientific method in favor of ignorance and superstition. But our moral lag must be redeemed. When scientific power outruns moral power, we end up with guided missiles and misguided men. When we foolishly maximize the minimum and minimize the maximum, we sign the warrant for our own day of doom. It is this moral lag in our thing-oriented society that blinds us to the human realities around us and encourages us in the greed and exploitation which create the sector of poverty in the midst of wealth. Again, we have deluded ourselves into believing the myth that capitalism grew and prospered out of the Protestant ethic of hard work and sacrifice. The fact is that capitalism was built on the exploitation and suffering of black slaves. And continues to thrive on the exploitation of the poor, both black and white, both here and abroad. If Negroes and poor whites do not participate in the free flow of wealth within our economy, they will forever be poor, giving their energy, their talents, and their limited funds to the consumer market, but reaping few benefits and services in return. The way to end poverty is to end the exploitation of the poor, ensure them a fair share of the government's services and the nation's resources. I proposed recently that a national agency be established to provide employment for everyone needing it. Nothing is more socially inexcusable than unemployment in this age. In the 30s, when the nation was bankrupt, it instituted such an agency, the WPA. In the present conditions of a nation glutted with resources, it is barbarous to condemn people desiring work to soul-sapping inactivity and poverty. And I am convinced that even this one massive act of concern would do more than all the state police and armies of the nation to quell riots and instill hatreds. And the tragedy is that our materialistic culture does not possess the statesmanship necessary to do it. Victor Hugo could have been thinking of 20th century America when he wrote, "There's always more misery among the lower classes than there is humanity in the higher classes." The time has come for America to face the inevitable choice between materialism and humanism. We must devote at least as much to our children's education and the health of the poor as we do to the care of our automobiles and the building of beautiful, impressive hotels. And we must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power. We must further recognize that the ghetto is a domestic colony. Black people must develop programs that will aid in the transfer of power and wealth into the hands of residents of the ghetto so that they may in reality control their own destinies. This is the meaning of new politics. People of goodwill in the larger community must support the black man in this effort. The final phase of our national sickness is the disease of militarism. Nothing more clearly demonstrates our nation's abuse of military power than our tragic adventure in Vietnam. This war has played havoc with the destiny of the entire world. It has torn up the Geneva Agreement. It has seriously impaired the United Nations. It has exacerbated the hatred between continents and, worse still, between races. It has frustrated our development of home at home, telling our own underprivileged citizens that we place insatiable military demands above their most critical needs. It has greatly contributed to the forces of reaction in America and strengthened the military-industrial complex. And it has practically destroyed Vietnam and left thousands of American and Vietnamese youth maimed and mutilated, and expose the whole world to the risk of nuclear warfare. Above all, the war in Vietnam has revealed what Senator Fulbright calls our nation's arrogance of power. We are arrogant in...